Hello, and welcome to Energy Oracles. I'm Paul Hicken, Editor-in-Chief at Petroleum Economist, and I'm joined by Seth Haskell, one of our in-house experts to discuss the so-called recent pause on US LNG projects. Now, the Biden administration's headline-grabbing news to freeze all new US LNG export approvals has garnered a lot of grandstanding, a lot of posturing, and a lot of hyperbole about potentially its environmental claims and what it can achieve and the damage it could potentially do to the fossil fuel industry. But cutting through all that noise, it's actually a bit more banal and more maybe symbolic than substantial. And maybe Seth, you can elaborate a little bit more on the actual implications of what's going on.
Thanks, Paul. Happy to be here. I think last time we were on a podcast together, we were also talking about US LNG. So get to pick up some of those strands together here. Yeah, I think the big question facing the industry at the moment is how serious this pause is. So literally what's happening is, and what the administration has said it's doing is it's pausing the approval process for the Department of Energy to grant export permits to export LNG to non-free trade agreement nations. And that's essentially all nations. There's very few countries with free trade and natural gas agreements with the US, and they represent quite a small market. So if you are a project that has not been permitted to export to non-free trade agreement nations, which essentially, are you not under construction already, you need such a permit, and that has now been paused while the administration reviews the process for issuing those permits. And this is something that has happened before. It happened in 2012, I believe, and also in 2018, when the administration essentially said, LNG is kind of new. Administration at those times said the LNG is kind of new. We need to figure out a review process for this that takes into account all of the impacts it has. The DOE has a remit to investigate whether projects are in the public interest. So the idea is, let's expand when we're considering what's in the public interest for these projects. Now, the language that the Biden administration has couched their announcement in is very climate-centric. So, there's reference to what's the impact of LNG exports on U.S. natural gas prices. But there's also, this is the first paragraph is, there's hurricanes and wildfires and we care about the climate crisis. And the last three paragraphs are all the things Biden has done to address the climate crisis in the past. So I think the headline here, although there are other considerations in terms of, perhaps they'll expand the review process for what the impact is on domestic natural gas prices in the U.S. The headline process here is that they're looking to consider the impact of these export terminals' greenhouse gas emissions over their lifetime as part of that public interest review. So are these terminals good or bad for the climate? And is that something we should consider when we're approving them as part of the DOE export process? So that could be a lot of things. And that's the uncertainty here. Is the administration going to look at these terminals and decide that, any new export projects are bad enough for the climate that they need to be stopped, and they'll function as an essential ban on additional permitting approval, and that would endanger a lot of capacity. I mean, I'll give the biggest number you can give, which is around 100 million tons per year. More reasonable number, though, you could put 50 million tons per year there. That's a lot of capacity. That's more than 10% of the export capacity that exists globally right now. That could be a big deal if this ends up working as a functional ban. Of course, this could also just be exactly what the administration says, which is just a pause, which is still a big deal because these projects are going to be delayed 12 to 18 months while they review this process, while they restart the review process for projects to then review them under the new terms, in the new year, which will surely be a more stringent review process that will take longer. There'll be a slowdown here, potentially a cancellation, not clear which.
And if we could talk about a little bit about which projects are most vulnerable here, which ones are the big ones that you'd see that are most at risk?
Yeah, so the two that come to mind right away are Commonwealth LNG and Calcasieu Pass 2, CP2. And that's a Venture Global project, and Commonwealth LNG is independent. So collectively, that's about 20 million tons per year of capacity. And in my reading, both of those projects were essentially waiting on export permit approval in order to take FID and move forward. And as in, if they received export permit approval now, I would have expected FID to happen within a month, maybe two. So the reason I say that is that in the case of CP2, it's a phased project. It's a total 20 million ton per year project, but they're building it in phases. So two 10 million ton per year phases. The first phase of that project, the first 10 million ton per year phase, it's got something like 9 million tons per year of sales and purchase agreements lined up. So this is a pretty slam dunk economically. You know, they know the demand for their product is lined up. They're ready to do it. For Commonwealth LNG, it's a little bit more complicated. They only have 2 to 3 million tons per year of SPAs lined up, but they lined up a whole host of heads of agreements with companies like Gunvor and Summit Oil in Bangladesh. Kimmeridge, I believe, has a heads of agreement with them. There's a couple other ones as well, Net as well. So my read from the outside on these heads of agreements is that essentially, these companies were waiting to see what happened with the export permit approval process in order to firm up these agreements. And that if an export permit approval had been granted, they would have been firmed up very quickly and we would have moved to FID very quickly. And I say that because Commonwealth LNG's non-free trade agreement export permit has been sort of languishing for an unusually long amount of time. And it's not quite clear what the story is there, perhaps an indication of an early of this policy change earlier. You know, it's been usually these export permits were granted within a couple months of a project receiving FERC approval, and Commonwealth has received FERC approval in 2022, November 2022, and you know they still don't have an export permit. So there was a little bit of what's going on here. So I think companies were waiting to see what would happen with that export permit approval before they firmed up. So those are the two projects that are most immediately impacted. But there's a host of other projects. I mean, you mentioned to me before we started talking, Port Arthur Phase 2. There's a project that's FERC approved that's waiting on DOE approval, but doesn't quite have the SPAs lined up. But also looking at train expansions, it's being passed for Cheniere, as well as at Corpus Christi liquefaction for Cheniere. There's expansion projects there that are going to be held up as a result of this policy change. And then a lot of other smaller projects. I mean, you're looking at or more early stage projects, things like Lake Charles LNG, Freeport Train 4. So there is a whole train here. But I think those two big ones right away, you know, Calcasieu Pass and Commonwealth, those guys, I think you would have expected FID in the next couple months without this policy change.
It's amazing, really. I just wanted to take it back a step to the wider issue, which it seems like LNG and gas has been the ultimate energy and climate fumble by the whole industry, by policymakers. You saw that COP28 didn't really have much of a reference to gas, kind of seen as a transition fuel, but environmentalists want to call it a fossil fuel and attack it for that. You've got the industry itself saying, well, what about coal to gas switching being crucial in terms of cleaning up emissions, crucial for energy security. Even in the US, you know, you look at it from one side and the US now is the ultimate oil and gas provider, number one, and never has it probably thought that kind of some kind of energy independence, although that's pretty much a myth, but it's that kind of ideal looks so vulnerable and so uncertain and so weak at foot. It's incredible. And you see the situation where I'm trying to think about Biden administration, he's in some ways he's been attacked, but he's also been fairly favorable to the fossil fuel industry. And you saw it with Willow, a lot of flip-flopping over that. And then the ConocoPhillips' Willow development in Alaska got approved, but there were certain things that were blocked at the same time in terms of on environmental grounds. And even this pause, it allows, you know, we go into an election year in the US and with Trump, you know, obviously known as a very friendly to the fossil fuel industry. And this pause almost, does it allow us just to get through to the elections and then we all start again as a same situation as it was prior to this pause? What's your take on the kind of the wider context of this situation?
Yeah, I think you mentioned a few things that I'll touch on. One is I want to talk about the political politics of it, not too much, but I have seen this floating around. I don't think we quite have a good sense of what is driving this politically. I've certainly seen, you know, Biden's been under attack from the left recently. This is something for the left, but I'm dubious that climate policies are popular generally. They need to be pursued despite being unpopular. I'm a little bit, dubious of that argument because I'm just not convinced that climate policies are popular. I also think that this policy has been discussed. I mean, it came up when we last talked about US LNG, that there's been rumors floating around that this exact policy change, that we're going to start looking at climate emissions, climate change impact as part of the public interest remand at the US DOE. I mean, that's been around for 6 months, 8 months. I mean, people have been talking about it a little bit. I was certainly did not think it would happen, but I was aware of it. So I think any sort of, there's a very short term like political bounce here. I think more likely, and my general sense of how politics happens, this is an idea that's been gestating for a long time with people in the administration, particularly within the DOE. And, perhaps political motives tipped it one way or the other. But it didn't come out of nowhere. This is something that's been going on for a while. The other thing I want to quickly touch on is you talked about like the climate arguments here, and I want to run through those because I mean, cards on the table, I think this is a bad policy change from the perspective. I think it doesn't do too much for the climate while being, bad for the industry. I want to go through those climate arguments so people can hear them. And first, you have this idea that natural gas is much worse for, or liquefied natural gas in particular, is much worse for the environment than generally accepted. And this is something that, climate activists who have been involved in trying to stop these terminals and trying to convince the Biden administration to take these positions, people like Bill McKibben, they lean on this argument quite heavily, which is to look at essentially if you methane emissions along the whole supply chain for natural gas, this is obviously a huge issue in the industry. Those emissions are quite hard to pin down exactly how much is escaping at various points along the upstream. So if you pick a very high number for what's escaping, something like 3.5%, as opposed to, the official numbers, which tend to be around 1.5%, or the, I'm going to say actual numbers, when people go out in the US, they tend to get a number around 2.5%. And if you pick a higher number, and then you also pick a shorter time frame for your climate model, which is, not a completely unreasonable thing to do, because methane is quite a fast dissipating greenhouse gas. It disappears within 10, 20 years of entering the atmosphere, unlike CO2, which sticks around for hundreds of years. You can end up with very severe climate impacts from liquefied natural gas over the next 20 years. But if you look at a longer climate model, even if you're looking at higher methane emissions numbers, you're still saying, okay, natural gas is much, much better than coal. But it's possible to spin a model that's not from nowhere that tells you that natural gas is quite bad for the climate. And I think that's motivating a lot of the thinking on this topic. The other two issues to bring up are that climate related are, there's sort of a connection here with domestic natural gas price consideration. Because if an enormous amount of new capacity is built in the US, that is going to start impacting domestic natural gas prices by making them notably higher. But I actually don't think that would happen because I think the industry upstream is capable of meeting that demand. I mean, you can increase production in the US to, cope with this extra LNG export demand. But then you're kind of saying, well, we're increasing fossil fuel production, dropping prices. There's a certain emotional element here where the amount of capacity that will exist globally for LNG export in 2035 is greater than the total. If you look at net zero emission scenarios, and there's obviously many net zero emission scenarios, but if you look at net zero emission scenarios put out by the IEA, they're looking at 900 billion cubic meters per year should be global gas demand in 2050. Well, that's about how much LNG I expect will be being produced every year in 2050. So there's a certain acknowledgement that we're just not going to hit those targets by building these terminals. But I don't think the policy is hitting the right place. You want to hit demand. There's no stopping the LNG doesn't really change that equation, even if it is a little bit galling to just be acknowledging we're missing targets like that.
Isn't there kind of an oxymoron almost that actually, which is the kind of tension in the industry, if actually you invest more in LNG, you actually create more, you create more supply, you bring down prices, you make it more competitive. One, you improve affordability for a lot of people, especially in poorer climates. The other key thing about this is that you make it competitive with coal. And the sense is that because coal is so cheap, that if you can bring down the price of gas, then ultimately you make it more likely that not just in the US but elsewhere that they'll go towards gas, which is the big win in terms of emissions, which is what I think the US Chamber of Commerce made an argument about that as well. And isn't there that side of the argument that actually in the here and now that actually more gas could actually in a way would actually reduce the pressure on emissions, conversely, suggesting that all that money that's invested in renewables and can actually meet that extra energy demand globally, maybe not in the US, but globally. So there is a complicated circular argument going on as well, no?
I agree with you, Paul. Yeah, I mean, I think probably more LNG. I mean, there's something to be said for, you make energy cheaper, you increase energy demand. Energy demand goes up, probably bad for the climate, but good for people. I think you're right. I don't think hitting LNG is particularly great from a climate perspective. I mean, you can argue, perhaps gas is competing more with renewables than it's competing with coal. I don't think that's true, but certainly that's something that some people would suggest. I mostly just don't think that this is a big climate issue. I don't think, LNG, I don't think LNG is going to make wonderful decarbonization for the world. But I also don't think it's a net terrible impact either. I just think this is it's a policy that's trying to improve the climate situation that I think will not do so much for the climate situation, while also, hurting the industry. And in that case, why are you doing it? That being said, I want to take a step back here and say what I said at the beginning of this conversation, which we don't quite know what the contours of this policy are yet. If the net effect of this is all that just these terminals all get delayed an extra, 14 months, that's not amazing, but it's certainly not like, wow, a dramatic policy shift. If anything, there's arguments to be made that a delay of 14 months won't even be that bad. And this would be to say that at the moment, the LNG supply chain is construction supply chain is stressed a little bit. Bechtel is building 4 terminals in the US alone. The ability of the LNG construction supply chain to absorb an extra, 50 million tons per year of LNG construction this year. I mean, I would expect terminals to see delays anyway, if they were moving forward at the moment. So if they get delayed 14 months, they might not actually, if the start of construction gets delayed 14 months, might not actually delay startup by 14 months because, the supply chain situation is going to be a little bit easier 14 months from now. When Golden Pass trains start finishing and the latter half of these LNG terminal construction process is going to be a little bit easier because they're not going to be competing with the 200 and some million tons per year of LNG export capacity under construction globally right now.
And if there is a more stringent environmental standards to meet, then potentially that gives more credence and weight to the LNG argument. If you can stand it up a little bit more against certain criteria, then maybe that's a potential win going forward and a bit more of a robust argument for investing in LNG. And before we wrap up, I just wanted to also talk a little bit about the winners and losers in these situations, if things, depending on how it pans out. But it's interesting again because it plays out against an energy security background of Russia, which, as we all know, for the past 2 years has had an uneasy relationship with providing supply to Europe, and obviously US being has been the one of the big winners from that scenario. But then you've seen with US coming on as the number one, and the other big players like Qatar and Australia obviously think they may start to benefit if LNG projects are curtailed in the US. And you see around the world that Argentina and even Saudi Arabia, known as kind of an oil producer, but has lots of ambitions around, upping its gas LNG ability, especially all the hydrocarbons it has there. So what's your sense of the sort of winners and losers on this situation?
Yeah, well, I think looking at the US first, there's a couple projects that perhaps stand to win from this policy. And that's essentially, are you a project that's already permitted and can meet your export commencement deadline? And I think the one for that is Glenfarne has a project, Texas LNG, quite small, 4 million tons per year. But I mean, they have an export commencement deadline in 2027. They're looking to start up in 2027. You know, that project looks a lot better than it did 2 months ago. I mean, you're like, wow, they can just go. So if you've got money floating around and you were looking to invest in these other terminals, I mean, you might want to look at Texas LNG. More dubiously, next decade's Rio Grande LNG, they hold export commencement deadlines for 27 million tons per year of capacity. They're currently only building about 17 million tons per year of capacity. There's two additional trains that they're developing. They've already agreed to EPC terms with Bechtel, I believe. So I think they would be hard-pressed to finish those two additional trains before their deadline in 2027. But it's certainly something they might think about, potentially apply for an extension to their export commencement deadline, you know, with construction almost done. That's maybe more likely to be granted. They're also, next decade, incorporating CCUS in the terminal. These are electric drive trains. So there's, you know, a better climate argument to make for that project. So that's something to look for as well. And that's quite a bit more capacity. Outside of the U.S., there's actually like surprisingly little LNG capacity that's sort of ready to go. In Canada, you maybe see Le Sims, you know, that's the First Nation sponsored project on the West Coast, Cedar LNG. But beyond that, I mean, Abadi LNG in Indonesia. And then I think there's a lot of African projects that start looking a little bit better. And, you know, all these Nigeria FLNGs and Mozambique, you know, maybe Total Energies wants to get that restarted sooner than they otherwise would. But, you know, the same issues with African projects that there always are, are still going to be issues for those projects. It's going to be hard for them to find financing. So I actually don't think there's like a lot of projects that wouldn't have otherwise gone forward globally that will go forward. And part of that is just, you know, gas in the U.S. is cheap, and it's a really good place to do LNG because gas is cheap and that'll do it. And there's not a lot of other places that can match the U.S. on that front.
Thanks, Seth.
Yeah, certainly Africa is also, you know, had got a lot of gas LNG projects. A good point to mention as well. And obviously, where energy security is a crucial issue and energy affordability. I'd like to leave it there. I'd like to say thanks to Seth Haskell from the GEI team, who looks at attracts lots of projects and infrastructure across a whole range of energies. And from myself, a petroleum economist, and check out Hydro Economist and Carbon Economist. Thanks for listening.